These are the Target Files, taking a 21st century look back at the 20th century adventures of the Doctor in novelization and audiobook form, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
This is the Target Files, and this is episode 60 on Robots of Death by Terence Dix, bookwise, and new audiobook by Terence Dix as well, but read by Louise Jameson. Hi, this is Alex in Exeter.
And hello from Mike in Swansea.
So, what did we think of Robots of Death? I thought it was a really, really good new reading by Lou Jameson, and a bit tricky to try and get hold of the actual TV episode because I couldn't seem to find it anywhere, so I think they might be bringing out a new version soon. But overall, really parallel between robots and humans and how, you know, technology is taking over, so I did enjoy it. What did you think, Mike?
Yes, Al, I wasn't sure I actually had it on DVD, but then spotted on my shelf, it was in one of the Revisitations box sets they brought out a special edition a few years ago.
Yeah, that must be the only way of getting it, unfortunately, because I tried getting off Amazon and it wasn't a version you could get hold of, unfortunately. But it's, I think what I've seen, the clip-wise, is some really good special effects, I think, in this these episodes.
Oh, definitely. For early 1977, just a few months before I was born, this story first broadcast in the Fourth Doctor era. Book-wise, for me, overall, or teaser thoughts, I wonder how much it does actually add to the story, because one of the most memorable parts about the TV version is the whole design, the whole fact that the Sandminer ship is done in a very Art Deco style, and a documentary on the DVD release states that it's such a memorable story for that reason, but it is an exceptional piece of storytelling as well. But do you miss out on the performances and the things in the book, you know, which is an interesting way of looking at Targets, I think, in terms of a lot of the ones we've covered so far. We seem to think they add flourishes and they add excitement to the TV stories, but I'm not sure how much it actually does.
Yeah, I would agree, because I think, you know, because it's got such really good special effects in the actual TV when I've seen it before, and the sort of very special with the Sandminer and everything. Well, I think, though it's very well described in the book, and you know, Lou Jameson does an excellent performance on the audio, but I think, like you, I think it does let it down because it's so visual, I think, these episodes, you know, with all the different things that happen on the Sandminder. But I think sometimes the book can let it down, which is a, you know, difference for a Target book, where the Target book normally does the opposite, I think.
Yes, I mean, Target books normally add to the scale of episodes, don't they? But I think the model work in this story on TV was so good. It is quite a sort of studio-based story then, in terms of it only being set on board one specific Sandminer spaceship. And I think that adds to the elements in the TV version, and Terence Dix does his best to expand upon the script by Chris Boucher. There's a few small differences throughout, but it's enjoyable enough, and Louise Jameson's performance does add quite a lot to it.
Yeah, I think the performance of Jameson's new audiobook is really, really good. It's the bits of Leela are really, you know, exciting, and I think they work very well. And I think bits of the computer voices of her are really good. And I think the audiobook does add something to it. Like you, I think there's not a great deal of difference between the book and the actual episodes, I think.
No, would you say, you know, is it a Terence paint by numbers, or does he add significantly more depth than that?
I don't think it's a paint by numbers, but I think there isn't a great deal added. I think it is pretty close to the script, because maybe he thought the script was that good it didn't really need much when it came to the book.
Yes, I think it's within the period, this one, where he was more or less churning them out, but that does him a bit of a disservice, because he is such a talented writer. You know, he can do the engaging character-based stuff, and he can bring a greater scale to the action than we used to get on the budgets on TV.
Oh, definitely. You know, the other books we've discussed of Terence Dicks is they are really action-filled. They're always grim. And this one has a great deal of that as well, and some really quite nasty bits. I can never remember, is this after the Robert Holmes and, you know, period of real nastiness, or is it in that same period?
Just following on, I think, do you mean sort of Talons of Wang Chiang and the Android Invasion Pyramids?
Yeah, that period of the real sort of nasty, you know, the Tom Baker, which has all the great things, what people got quite worried about.
I believe they were 1975 going on for 76, and this was January or February 77, so just afterwards. I think Graham Williams had just come in to take over.
I think the feeling is still trying to make this quite adult, because I found it was quite, you know, quite a dark book, the amount of death and nastiness what's in it.
Yes, plenty of character-based stuff, and quite early on in the story we see scientific-based theory. There's the idea of transcendentalism, isn't there, within the TARDIS, and the Doctor chooses to explain to Leela how the perception can be changed, and as the TARDIS is in separate dimensions by using a set of boxes.
Yeah, that's a really nice scene between him and Leela, and the sort of yo-yo bits also in that bit are quite fun. But it's a very interesting way, you know, describing, you know, how one box looks smaller the further you look away from it. I don't think Leela still gets it.
I'm not entirely sure if I do, Al. I think I prefer the first Doctor's explanation in An Unearthly Child, where he explains how, I think it's Chesterton who asks him how it's bigger on the inside. And the Doctor makes the analogy to the TV set, doesn't he? Saying, you know, your species, you watch people on television, you know, appearing small. Not so much with the massive TVs we have nowadays, but I think that was given to me as a greater, probably more simplistic understanding of it.
Oh, I'll definitely. It is still a little bit complicated, even with the whole box thing. I think Leela doesn't get it at all, I don't think.
Yes, and themes in this story, references, they've really gone back to the Isaac Asimov reference of robophobia.
Yeah, there's a very, the whole sort of, you know, the code of the robot is definitely mentioned throughout this, now they're not meant to be able to kill because they've been sort of robophobia, they can kill basically. And there's been a rather good spin and a sort of continuation of this called Robophobia Big Finish did, which is very interesting.
Okay, do you have any of the same characters who survived?
You don't have the same characters, but you have sort of mentions of them, and it's another sort of big spaceship which it's gone completely rogue of robophobia, basically.
Yes, memorable characters who stood out for you, Al. Certainly twos for me, Pamela Salem, who's returned in the McCoy era in Remembrance of the Daleks, and as part of the Countermeasures team, which are on Big Finish now as well.
Yes, he's very sort of strong, fourth word. That's why I remember her character names. I'm always hopeless to remember.
Twos, it was twos.
That's it, twos. And he stands out for the whole sort of whole book, I think. You know, she's sort of right to the end, where, you know, she's sort of there as the main sort of strong female sort of character. I think it's quite an interesting between her and Leela, I think.
Yes, slightly more advanced in, well, obviously, in terms of the time period the Doctor and Leela arrive at, and she lives in, and I think this is one of Leela's first stories, I believe.
Yeah, it's the second one after the, you know, they sort of meet the characters, the face of evil is her first sort of adventure, this one is.
Yes, and as we said before, Leela has a great emotional intelligence and perceptiveness, doesn't she? But there are, of course, elements of savagery, but it's more to do with protecting herself than out-and-out bloodlust.
Oh, definitely in this. It's not as savage as he can be. It's sort of more understanding her place and sort of, you know, protecting herself when things happen. And I think slightly that's why she sort of sympathises with some of the robots, because they have the same sort of ethos, I think.
Yes, and onto Lou's performance in the audiobook. She has a very soothing voice at times, but she's able to help ramp up the tension in the more tense and exciting moments.
Oh, most definitely. I think her performance is great throughout this audiobook because he does so many different things. He's sort of like playing all these very sort of, you know, relaxed robots who are going around killing people, basically. And her whole performance is great. Maybe didn't quite get Tom's voice, which is a bit of a shame. But otherwise, I thought when she's doing her Leela voice, it was brilliant.
So hard to get Tom's voice unless you're the man himself or perhaps John Culshaw at times. But I think she makes a very reasonable effort. She doesn't go over the top as many people do when they all think they can take off Tom.
Yes, indeed. I think that performance is really good because really good soundscape. I think they were actually using some of the original music from Robots of Death this time, and it really worked, I think.
And not overly invasive, you know, not as we've heard in some of the releases. We have to hear a door swinging open every time a door opens, or we have to hear explosions rumbling, which take out your speakers throughout your house and your floors if you've got them on a hard surface.
Yeah, I know. There wasn't quite a nice explosion this with the sandstormer, but I agree. It wasn't, as we all find with some audiobooks, the background and all the sound effects can be a bit over the top. But this was just right, I thought, you know, and it was a nice balance of tension being ramped up by bits of the original music and sort of nice sound effects.
I'd seen this noticed on a online forum and then did notice it myself in the reading. You have the name of Karen Tappel, which sounds a lot more sort of noble and more like an inventor in the TV version, but Lou pronounces it as Karen Tappel, which sounds like a human resources employee somewhere to me.
It does sound a bit weird, doesn't it? It's sort of very sort of bland name of a guy who, you know, that great twist at the end, we won't spoil quite yet, but it's a very sort of bland name for a scientist, you know, creates the whole robot species in this world.
Yes, interesting choice that for pronunciation. Whether it's Louise or the director or the producer, we're not sure. Let us know, folks, at DW Target Files on Twitter. And the other strange decision I found was the idea of the robot at the end, I think one who's locked away from the main action. And we hear them crying out, and it's a pure Alvin and the Chipmunk-style voice.
Yeah, it's because I think of the whole the way that they've been given, the stuff what's in Helium, that's what I was thinking of, Helium to stop him controlling what, and it's very funny, whereas he goes very squeaky.
Yes, you know, it just, does it produce a little bit too much humour at the end? You know, did it really, I'm not sure if it really needed that. I suppose it does fit in with the idea of Helium being a solution.
Maybe does dampen it a little bit when you've had all this, what might be needed, because you've had quite a bit of bloodlusty robots beforehand sort of trying to kill everybody, so maybe a smidgen. But I can see where you're coming from, because it sort of does take out the tension of the whole of the last two chapters.
One question I wanted to ask about this book, you know, we mentioned how the TV versions can be enhanced sometimes by the Target novelizations, or fairly often, to be honest, and I did wonder at the beginning, posing the question whether this is a reversal of that and you get more from the whole excellent Art Deco design of the sets and the lighting and the direction and the performances in the TV version. Do you feel sometimes Target novels give you too much exposition?
Well, I'm on the feeling that we just did recently Ghostlight, which was ginormous with exposition and gave you tons more than they had. So I think it depends on the writer of the Target book, really. You know, it depends if they want to just do that sort of bit what Terence does normally at the beginning, where he gives you like the back history of the Doctor normally, or want to give you loads like Mark Platt did with Ghostlight, where we had, you know, really long chapters because he was adding all the stuff what he didn't get in, basically. I think it's down to the writer, really.
Yeah, I suppose with Ghostlight you needed to have the opening paragraph about Ace to make the twist help to make sense in the end, whereas in the TV version it was just given away as the line at the end.
Yeah, I think that did help in some bits of Ghostlight. Well, I think it was, you know, too expansive. We've mentioned in the past, it sort of added everything. And that can sometimes be too much, where I think it depends on the author, because it depends how, and it also probably depends on the episode, you know, like with Robots of Death, everything's really there in the episode, so you don't really need to do much with the book, really.
Yes, I think Terence made a few sort of small changes. He reversed the idea of the boxes at the beginning to show the transcendentalism within the TARDIS. You know, I think he put the larger box on the central console, whereas the Doctor puts the smaller one on the console in the TV version.
Yeah, I did wonder about him, because having a smaller to a larger would make more sense, really.
Unlike the TV serial from TARDISwikia.com, folks, the robots were all described as silver, which sort of takes away the whole excellent design facet of the robots themselves.
Yeah, because they've got that sort of different colouring to show their different sort of level, haven't they? That's what I think the point of it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a class system within robots. How do you feel that came across in the story?
I think it comes along very well, really, because you've got the super superior bots and you've got the really low down, but then you get that great twist where the one who's meant to be the lowest is actually the cleverest, basically. You know, he's the this person's working for the company, basically. So that one who can, you know, who's meant to be the dumbest and thickest is actually the cleverest. I thought it was a really good twist.
Reminiscent of the Doctor himself, you know, acting the buffoon in the room, but he's all along he's the most clever.
Oh, definitely, definitely. That's the whole sort of Doctor theory, you know, after the madman in a box outlook. So, what lovely covers do we have for this book, Mike?
Yes, the initial edition in the 70s, Al. Doctor Who, the classic curved red lettering on the white background. Who, with the white rim of those three letters. And the robots of death in white, Terence Dix underneath. The Doctor next to one of the robots with the, what's the name of the implement they use to destroy?
Oh, the sort of probe thing, isn't it?
The probe. He's holding the probe next to one of the robots with the excellent swept back hairstyle. It's quite clearly Tom with a sort of fuzzy split ends on his hair, and the scarf is there. It gives you quite a lot of intrigue, I think. Pretty decent one. A John Geary cover. Not come across his work before on these podcasts.
No, we haven't. Well, that looks quite a nice one. It sort of tells you a bit of everything. That's quite good.
Although I suppose the way it's photographed on this TARDIS Wikia page, it looks slightly drab because of the Doctor's brown jacket and there's a green background, and you don't really get the whole majesty of the robots themselves, although, as we just mentioned, they don't have the different colours within this novelisation as they're described.
No, I suppose I don't, because it's a probably recreated one, isn't it?
Yes, and then we had Alistair Pearson in 1991, a reprint. The background black ribbon familiar across the top. The McCoy era logo again. The Robots of Death, based on a Doctor Who adventure first broadcast in 1977. A sort of panel setting. Tom looking full on from the front, the same sort of hairstyle, but we get a shot of his face, whole face, rather than just the profile in the previous one. Two of the robots next to each other over a sort of pillar system in the background, and at the bottom there's a green picture of the sand miner looking a little bit like a steam train to me at the moment. That gives you, I think, fairly enough intrigue, but I think I would prefer the John Geary, the first one.
Yeah, because I think that's an overkill, really, that one. It looks nice, but I think the John Geary one's better. It sort of gives you ideas, but doesn't tell you everything, I think.
I think they've recreated that John Geary one for the BBC audiobook released at the beginning of this month, February 2018, folks. It's spruced up the colours a little bit. The actual robot is, would the phrase be more gold? It shows up
gold?
A certain amount of brightness. Gold-y? Yeah, the eyes are certainly redder. We have the McGann era, mixture of McGann and Pertwee era Doctor Who logo in white, which is quite familiar for all these CD audiobook releases nowadays. So that's a pretty good one as well. You know, it's pretty reminiscent and a nice nod to the original one from the 70s.
Yeah, I think that one works well because I've obviously got the colour palette slightly better than the original. I think that is the best one, I think. So my final thoughts and scores on Robots of Death is I think it's a very interesting book. It has lots of things going on. Could be that it's one of the ones which is a bit interesting because it's actually not as good as the TV episodes, the book. I think the audiobook came out this month with Lou Jameson. It's very good. She reads it very well. She does all the different robots very well, different voices. So it sort of pans out very nice. Good soundscape with sort of original Robots of Death music. So I'd probably give the book maybe a 7 and the audiobook an 8.5, I think.
Three different scales, 8.5 for the TV version. I just feel it's so well acted, so well designed, that lovely Art Deco. I love the phrase, I'll mention it once more. Well written by Chris Boucher, the TV version, well directed. Tom's very good in this story. Louise Jameson really coming into her own, really showing that empathic nature without the out-and-out savagery or bloodlust of Leela. I'd go for an 8 for the audiobook. Louise really makes the words come off the page. Excellent soundscape, sound design. Not too invasive of certain moments. And the actual text itself, I'd give a 7.5 for that, I think, for Terence's words. You know, it's a pretty decent transfer off the page. Probably would be exciting enough, but I do feel the audiobook adds enough to be an 8, and then the TV is an 8.5.
Well, that's pretty good. Like, I agree. The audiobook is very, very good, thanks to Lou Jameson, and the episodes are just really... I think it's one of the... I think everybody thinks it's still one of the best Tom Baker Doctor Who episodes, I think. It's still up there, I think.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello, this is Alex, and this is Who's News on the 15th of February. First thing we need to mention is that people have spotted in Sheffield, England, Jodie Whittaker filming parts of the new episodes of Doctor Who, apparently coming out of the TARDIS with her three new companions. Doctor Who, Enemy of the World, one of the great Patrick Troughton stories that went missing, what has been re-found again, is coming out again on DVD on the 19th of March. This is due to the fact that the revisitation team, who recreate and make all the old episodes look beautiful, I think they can make it look even better than what it looks at the moment. So they are going to redo it and then bring it back out on a special DVD with lots of extras. From BigFinish.com this month, we have the finale box set of the Torchwood's Aliens Among Us. This is Volume 3. This is the final conclusion of Season 5 with really big spoilers and comebacks. I'm not going to say what, but the last 5 minutes have a new scene written by Russell T. Davis for one of his Torchwood characters. And we also get back somebody you wouldn't expect to be back. Big Finish have also launched this week their version of War of the Worlds, what has the original H.G. Wells title, Martian Invasion of Earth, which has a really good cast with such people as Richard Armitage from such things as Spooks and all other really good drama he's been in. Well worth a listen, as it has a fantastic score from Jamie Roberts. So let's talk about everything we've been watching, listening, you know, anything that's on TV, what we've been liking. What have I mean, myself, I think the best thing I watched this week was Collateral. It's the new David Hare's drama on BBC Two in England, also on the iPlayer, with a stellar cast of people. No, quite a few people on Doctor Who, really. It's got John Sims, Billy Piper, Nicola Walker. It's an interesting drama about basically a small event of a pizza guy being shot, but around that there's a lot more political stuff, so it's well worth a watch on the iPlayer. Film-wise, I went to see The Darkest Hour, which is the Winston Churchill film with Gary Oldman, which is off Oscars, and it's very good. Also went to see Phantom Thread, which is the Daniel Day-Lewis film. It's actually fantastic. Music-wise, I've been listening to soundtracks a lot this week. The Black Panther soundtrack done by Kendrick Lamar, which is very interesting. And the Phantom Thread soundtrack, which is done by Johnny Greenwood of Radiohead, which is beautiful. So, anyway, what about you, Mike?
Finally got round to seeing. Matt Lucas mentioned it. He just made it when we interviewed him last summer. It's called A Futile and Stupid Gesture, exclusive to Netflix. Certainly in the UK, around the world, It's about the life of a man called Doug Kenny, who was a co-creator of National Lampoon magazine in the 70s.
Did it go straight to Netflix, did it?
Yeah, it's called A Futile and Stupid Gesture, based on a book that was written a few years ago. Just fascinated by how the film was structured, really. You got a nice narrative device of the older version of Doug Kenny, played by an actor. If you know Doug's faked, you know, unfortunately, he didn't make it to that age. But, you know, Matt Lucas plays this man called Tony Hendra, who was a British contributor to National Lampoon magazine, then the radio show. And Matt just gets some absolutely fantastic scenes, which he really steals within. We get representations of world-famous actors from those days, such as John Belushi and Chevy Chase. And they are done without patronization. They are done, performed very well. If this film reminded me of anything in its tone of humour, it's, I don't know if you recall, the BBC over here did a sort of docudrama a few years ago about the whole controversy when Monty Python's Life of Brian was released in the 70s, and it was called Holy Flying Circus.
That is a really good watch. That is well worth watching.
Yeah, it's that sort
very,
of tone you
very
get.
Very funny, and it's got everybody thinks Michael Palin is nice, and they make him nasty. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and Michael Palin actually went on Twitter himself at the time saying, "I'm not sure Mrs. Palin is really like this," because they had his wife as the caricature of the woman that Terry Jones would often play in the series. Hello, that was sort of
it's
one.
It's just hilarious. I did really enjoy that when that was on a few years ago. It's
I think
if you like the Python films, you'll love it. It's very funny.
Yeah, if you can track that one down. So this Futile and Stupid Gesture, National Lampoon's origins movie, definitely borrows from that. We get a gentleman playing Chevy Chase, who was one of Doug Kenny's very best friends in real life, and it's taken elements of his performance, as in many films. Chevy falls over in a very funny way, and this character who's playing him, this young man, does the very same thing. But it's a very tongue-in-cheek film. Doug Kenny suffered from a lot of depression in his life, but it's dealt with very sensitively, and you don't lose the humour of somebody who really created something great in life with the whole National Lampoon's empire, really. And I think he worked on, he came up with the idea of National Lampoon's Animal House, and then he went on to work on Caddyshack in his short life and career. So, recommended. That's on Netflix, certainly in the UK, and I think around the world, folks.
Definitely. Most of that stuff is around the world as well as just UK. I'm trying to think. I have been watching. I've been watching some things on Netflix. Do you find it better when you can binge watch the whole thing? That's why I haven't really been watching the whole of Dark Lightning, because it's like one episode a week, like Star Trek was, and that's probably why I lost my thread with Star Trek. I need to finish that. I find it better when you can watch the whole thing.
I find it, being Generation XL like yourself, I find it a nice throwback to have to wait. You know, it's like Doctor Who. I'm glad they haven't got to the stage, certainly yet, where they're going to release Doctor Who as a full season at once. I like the week's wait. I've quite liked it with Discovery. I thought it was a pretty good season finale. A lot of people have moaned about the fact it was over quickly, and there was this huge fan service with a big cliffhanger at the end of the series. But
well, they'll get what they want, because it's going to be back. And all the Netflix, what he said, it's going to be back like some point next year. So yeah, You'll find out stuff, definitely.
So have you seen it now? Shall we discuss that huge cliffhanger?
I'm very behind. I've read I sort of know what happens. I've read some of the reviews, people moaning.
Yeah, well, should I mention this cliffhanger, folks, or?
Go on, mention it, because I do sort of know what's going on.
Well, they got the whole war issue over with pretty quickly, which people moaned about. And then we have Michael Burnham, the main character, back in this world towards the end. She's brought the Empress, played by Michelle Yeoh, back to this normal Prime Universe from the alternative one where she'd actually gone evil as a Emperor. And they've managed to con Starfleet into thinking that this is the real captain who died. And they managed to con them into thinking it's really her, so she's the captain of Discovery now, following Jason Isaacs' character's demise in this universe. And sort of Burnham has the job as first science officer, and you find out they're heading towards Vulcan at the end with her father, Sarek, father of Spock as well, of course. And they get an incoming message at the end, and you see the screen coming up saying this is an incoming message from a certain ship, and you just saw the letters NCC-170, and it cut away, and you thought, I know what's coming here. And they said this is a message from Captain Pike on the Enterprise, and we got a beautiful shot of the Enterprise as the cliffhanger going into Season 2. Now, I am wondering, Al, are we going to see it? Are we going to see... I don't think even in this original universe, that Kirk is on the ship yet. He may be, but Pike will be in charge.
So if Pike's there, I think Kirk came after Pike, I think.
Pike will be in charge. Spock should be the science officer. But now I'm wondering if it's just a big piece of trolling, you know. Are they going to sort of recast him again? Will they get Bruce Greenwood in as Pike and Zachary Quinto in as Spock from the alternative universe of the Abrams movies? You know, I'm not sure. It might be a big troll. They might sort of get onto the ship and perhaps it's been taken over by aliens. Perhaps it's a recreation. I'm not entirely sure we'll see all those old characters, but it was a nice cliffhanger.
I think it works, but I don't know what's going to happen with the movie franchise, because the movie franchise seems to have snarled again, I think. I know it did very well under the J.J. Abrams, and I thought it was really good, but I think it's sort of hit a point, because I think they want to concentrate just on Discovery, I think.
You never know with rumours are out there, but rumours came about shortly after the 50th anniversary film. I can't even remember what it was called. Now, Beyond, wasn't it?
Beyond.
Yeah, they said there was going to be a bit of time travel involved in any fourth film, with Chris Hemsworth back as Kirk's dad.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, a lot of people thought in that opening, that great opening scene in the first Abrams film, nearly 9 years ago now, that Hemsworth possibly would have made an even better Kirk than Chris Pine. But, I do like Chris Pine. I think he's really grown into it. And by the start of the third film, he's taken elements of Shatner, but he's not doing a total impersonation, which is really great, as he does need to put his own stamp on the character. And I think that's something we'll need to see from, I can't think of the gentleman's name, Alden Ehrenreich as Han Solo. We don't want to see an out-and-out impersonation of Harrison Ford, because no one will be able to pull that off.
Speaking of Solo, have you seen the trailer?
Yes, I'm very impressed by it. I wasn't sure what to make of the film.
As well, because because the directors have gone and they've put Ron Howard in control, it's going to be a turkey. Now, I think, I'm going to say this, I think the trailer, it looks better than Rogue One.
I think so. Did you actually know Grace Jones is in the trailer as an alien? I didn't know until someone told me this week.
But have you seen the stuff that's been murmured today?
What's that?
About the Obi-Wan Kenobi spin-off.
Oh, yeah, there's been various rumours of that. Will it be Ewan again?
I think
or
it's definitely happening now, because there was a thing in the Irish Herald yesterday.
Yes.
Apparently Lucas was looking for, he's in Ireland looking for actual places to be filmed in.
Come to Wales.
Yeah, we're thinking there's plenty of places in Wales that would look like Tatooine.
How all the studios in Cardiff now?
Yeah, exactly. We think there's plenty of places. I'm interested to see what that new Sky One drama done by Judy Goldwood's going to be like.
It's a Discovery of Witches.
Yeah, that's the one.
The first trailers have started to appear for that now.
Yeah, I saw that. So, well, I personally think about the Han Solo film. Everybody's going, oh, it's going to be rubbish. I think it looked pretty impressive the way they had it shot.
I think so, and I think Donald Glover really stood out. I really bought him as Lando straight away. But I do feel that they're keeping Alden Ehrenreich back a little bit, I think, just to, you know, they don't want to. It's going to be such a poison chalice almost for any actor, given there's so many generations now that have grown up with Harrison Ford.
Yeah, and it'll be very interesting, because I reckon they're going to bring him back for film 9, I reckon.
And that beautiful shot of the interior of the brand new Falcon was just something else, wasn't it?
Oh, it's stunning, isn't it? I know, I watched that a couple of times, saw that shot, and it does look stunning, that new Falcon. But it just looks really good, and I know people are going, oh, it's going to be lame. And you feel sorry for Americans, they're going to get absolutely bombarded in May with three mammoth films.
Absolutely, well, so are we probably. There's not much difference between the release dates nowadays.
I think one comes out in April, we haven't got all three at once.
Ah, there we are.
I think, you know, what you didn't see is who's Paul Bettany playing in Solo.
Ah, that's what they want to do, and you know, it looks to be a bit of a Dirty Dozen effort again, doesn't it? A bit like Rogue One.
Yeah, it's the Kessler run, everybody reckons it's going to be.
And so one other recommendation I made, which was on Sky just before Christmas, didn't have the greatest reviews, stumbled a bit, but I enjoyed it. I saw it advertised, decided to stick it on Series Link and binge-watched the 6 episodes over the last week or so, was a series called Bounty Hunters, which is sort of drug-based comedy. Jack Whitehall, the comedian over here, teaming up with a bounty hunter played by Rosie Perez. I don't know if you remember her. Was in the White Men Can't Jump movie with Woody Harrelson and
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Wesley Snipes, wasn't it?
What channel was that on?
That was on Sky One just for Christmas. It's called Bounty Hunters. It's been renewed for a second series.
I miss Jack Whitehall can be. He's very good when he can be good.
Yeah, he's playing that sort of classic repressed middle class English kid. You know, he's a student and he has to team up with his bounty hunter. You know, the whole plot is a little elaborate, but it's to do with looting that happens in the Middle East after ISIS take over a city, and certain terrorists are after certain artifacts which get into their hands. And we actually had a Doctor Who appearance from somebody who plays Jack Whitehall's sister, is Charity Wakefield, who appeared in Return of Doctor Mysterio as the main lady.
I think she's in the Cormoran Strike dramatisations now.
Yeah, I didn't realise she was British, actually, until she was in that, and I did a bit of Googling.
I don't know, because the accent's so good in Doctor Mysterio.
Yeah, I certainly thought they were both. I think the lad playing the superhero Mysterio was actually American, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Well, I think she wasn't. She's British, she is.
And interestingly enough, it's filmed in a very wide 2-1 scope, which is the way I think Doctor Who is going to turn out with Jodie Whittaker this autumn, and I was really impressed with it. Actually, it really gave you sort of a big feel to the screen, even though I've just got a 32-inch TV still. It gave a real sort of big dynamic to even that size screen, Al, so I'm really looking forward to how Doctor Who looks now.
I think I saw the new technology this week. I think I was watching Shetland on Tuesday, and that was very sort of in-your-face sort of brightness.
Yes, and 8K's coming now, folks, they said this year, so it's never-ending.
It's never ending. It always gets better. Well, if us people still in, you know, HD land, because they don't do 4K on Virgin, they should, but they don't. But that's why I still probably jump to Sky when you can get a box without a dish.
Yes, and I'm continuing on with my rewatch of Blake 7 following the 40th anniversary last month. On to season 3 now. It has slowed down a little now. They lose Blake, of course, at the end of season 2. Blake goes off for no apparent reason, and he's not there, certainly at this moment in season 3. Interested to see how that... Well, I know how it ends up at the end of season 4, but I'm interested to see how they get there in these remaining episodes.
Yeah, it's a good... I think what I can remember that I've seen for ages, it does lead up very nicely to the great thing at the end of season 4.
But they're all on YouTube, folks. I don't know if the DVDs have been deleted. They've never... If they've ever had huge box set releases.
I think you can get them. I think they might be able to still get them on Amazon. I haven't looked for ages.
And for years, I think around about 2010, Sky was saying, or a company said Sky was interested in a reboot, but that never came off. There's been talk of a movie, perhaps, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch as Avon and Tom Hardy as Blake could be good.
But the big finish things they've done in the last sort of 5-6 years, where they've sort of carried on things, have been very good. But it's money to buy, you know, you have to sort of, a big finish, the amount of ranges they do, you have to be a bit picky.
Yeah, so you have to work for them, you know.
We have to work for them and get freebies.
Excellent, Al. So we know there's a lot of Fourth Doctor stories to get through, so we're going to stay on with another Tom Baker one in about a fortnight's time for episode 61, aren't we, mate?
We are indeed. We're going to do the lovely... Brain of Morbius.
Yes, of course, written by Robin Bland, it was called, but I think it was a mixture of Terence Dix and someone else, wasn't it?
Yeah, is that the code name for Terence Dix and Robert Holmes came up with?
Something to do with payments and rights issues, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was something, but as I say, there's a very good audiobook, because we both got, read by the man himself, Tom Baker.
Yes, really looking forward to that one. You know, he's an excellent reader,
good.
Tom.
I think I've had it for 2 or 3 years now. It's actually one of the really good ones. So I shall go back and listen to that.
And sadly, we've not seen Tom do much work. Well, he's probably far too busy with Big Finish now to go back and do audiobooks.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to do many of the new ones because of the schedule, Big Finish and Babishan Productions, for the other thing he does, Baker's End, which is very funny and completely bonkers. Yeah, he doesn't seem to... I don't know, because it might be the time scale you have to spend in a studio, and I know it's apparently the other person, like Mark Billing and the Crime Writer, saying 2 days of reading is absolutely exhausting, apparently.
It must be, I guess, it must be, but Nick Briggs was interviewed by the excellent Canadian podcast, Radio Free Scaro, and he was mentioning how... you know, Billy was buzzing around the office at the end of her first day's work with David Tennant again, saying, "When can I come back? When can I come back?" So they're still capturing people in with that fabulous food they make at the Big Finish Studios, I think, and the lovely atmosphere there.
Oh, definitely. The lunches are meant to be fantastic at the Moat Studio.
So whatever you're doing this weekend, folks, if you're at Gallifrey 1 in LA, you lucky, lucky people, hope to make it there one day, enjoy that. And we'll speak to you soon, won't we, Al?
We will indeed, and we enjoy whatever you're doing.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files, will be discussing The Brain of Morbius, written by Terence Dix, and the audiobook performed by Tom Baker. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files handle, or search Facebook for the podcast page and leave us a message. Thanks for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, the Robots of Death review, featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. I Am the Doctor, composed originally by Murray Gold. Version for the podcast by Vale Mystery. Please do check out their YouTube channel, VAYLE Mystery. Newsround opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra, and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, the Robots of Death review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during February 2018.